Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Howdy, monkey.
You good?
Yeah, mate. All good. It's been a very busy but productive and fun-filled day. I just went down to London. A friend of mine who I'm staying with tonight, he just had a documentary about him screened at the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square. It was the debut sort of, you know, airing of the film. So, yeah, it's quite an exciting, fun night.
Oh, nice. What's the guy do? Why?
So did you ever see, I'm not sure if the show made it over to the States, but you might have sort of heard about it through, you know, your British pals. But Dirty Sanchez was the TV show that he was in, which was essentially like a UK counterpart to Jackass.
Okay.
So it was, you know, pranks, hijinks.
Okay.
And shenanigans. And since that show kind of fell by the wayside, you know, he's been through various different struggles, addiction and depression, but he sort of flipped it around. He came out of COVID and decided, because he's always had like an extreme kind of mentality, he rode the Atlantic Ocean with another guy, and they were on just like a tiny boat, and it took them 2 months, and they did, if you can imagine this, 2 hours on rowing, 2 hours off resting, 2 hours on rowing, nonstop for 2 months straight. So the documentary kind of traced his rise to fame, you know, going off the rails, the kind of come down that follows on from riding those highs to then, like, how do you turn that insane brain into something that's more productive, positive, and ultimately fulfilling and healthy. So yeah, man. The film's called The Road of Excess.
All right, I'll look out for it.
And it just had its first screening today, so they're in the process of shopping it around. But yeah, just a really inspiring tale of someone who's, you know, ridden the highest of highs, lowest of lows, and hits 15 and goes, well, what next? So how's life with you? What's been going on your end?
Well, it's not raining here.
No doubt.
It's supposed to actually be maybe hit 100 tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, unseasonably warm, actually. So I don't know. I'm just getting prepared to go out to the museum again at the beginning of the month. They've kind of themed it like a revolution weekend, based on, you know, French Revolution, Viva la Revolution, Anonymous, and so I'm kind of theming it, and I'm there on November the 5th, so they don't really know too much about Guy Fawkes out here. I was just in the process of putting together a post and with remember the 5th of November, and I didn't
remember the treason and plot.
But yeah, but you know, I didn't really get much past that as a kid. Gunpowder, treason, and plot, when you go around penny for the guy and the bonfire and all that. I was reading it yesterday. There's a whole second verse that goes on to shout the virtues of hanging the Pope and stuff like that.
I guess he was a terrorist, wasn't he?
Well, he was a punk rocker, mate, trying to blow up Parliament and the King.
It's the famous phrase, isn't it? That one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Yeah.
And, I guess Americans would have probably been introduced to that whole culture and story just through the V for Vendetta movies and comics.
They're using that imagery in some of the posts as well. So, yeah, it is very similar themes. But, yeah, there was, kind of brought back memories of going penny for the guy around the Council of State in Ipswich and, you know, throwing the effigy on the bonfire in the backyard with cheap bangers and rockets, throwing potatoes on the fire for dinner, you know, on the bonfire. And
miss a lot of home, of British culture? How long have you been in the States now? Been quite a while, right?
In the first week of December, it'll be 30 years.
Wow.
Are you, just as a point, are you using the video?
I will. Yeah, I've only recently started clipping it up for YouTube, because in this sort of digital age we're in now, I've been doing the podcast as an audio show for 7 years and do great numbers, and you know, found a really amazing audience during that time. But just the way everything shifted recently, I just put my first video up last week with episode 300, which is Billy Corgan. Okay. From the Smashing Pumpkins, and it immediately finds new eyes and ears because of the way that algorithm on that platform works. So, I mean, obviously there's little in the way of budget, as you can see here, because I'm kind of, I've literally just arrived back at my mate's house. So don't worry if your end looks a little bit DIY, because as you can see, we've got mold on the ceiling here. So
maybe you can put some nice backgrounds in for us when you...
I do fix it up and make it look good. Yeah, man.
Culturally, I do miss some stuff, but things have changed in the 30 years since I've been here, because when I moved out 1993, no internet. Again, just lived in a small apartment with my then girlfriend, who became my wife, who's now my ex-wife. But, no real money. And the only British news I got was from a newspaper called the British Weekly, which you would pick up in the pub once a week. And it was like a week behind football results and everything like that. So I kind of lost touch with that in the 90s, I think, until, got more connected through social media. So I don't miss living there. I do watch a lot of British TV.
What do you watch the most of, to keep connected in that sense?
I've never been really politically interested, but as political as I get, as I have I Got News for You.
Mm-hmm.
I like the panel shows. I like QI. I just watch as much of that as I can. And
classic.
I don't know. 8 out of 10 Cats and stuff. Those kind of, kind of light comedy show, but with a bit of smarts about them too,
I always think I'd love to be a guest on one of those shows, because it's kind of like you're riffing, aren't you? And you're bouncing off everyone. And I've always been a fan of free form entertainment, whatever that entertainment may be, whether it is music or theater or stand up. I love the idea of stepping either into a studio or on stage and kind of not really knowing what's going to happen. I mean, I don't know as a performer yourself, like how much of the Addicts live show is really, because there's the stage and the set and the visual presentation is really well thought out. And I'd love to talk to you about that. But how much of the kind of show itself for you guys is spontaneous and off the cuff, and how much is fairly well sort of dialed in, as it were?
Musically, it's dialed in. And as far as like the stage show regarding like props and stuff like that, and everything has a cue, you know, for maximum effect.
Of course.
But the best things are the spontaneous things, because I mean, you're there to, you know, create an atmosphere and a reaction from the audience. So you never really know what the people in front of you are going to do or how they're going to react. So lots of times we'll bounce off that and just go with it. And that may change the set, may change, you know, some of the more choreographed things. So we like to be loose and spontaneous, because they're kind of magical moments, really, that you didn't plan.
Amen.
And you can't plan it. You shouldn't plan it, you know.
And it's never the same twice, right? That's also the great thing, is like, even if you have a certain idea of a bit or an intro or whatever it might be, it's always going to vary dependent on the crowd, because every night is different, isn't it? If you're a performer who reacts in that way to an audience in that way in the moment.
Right. So there's a certain amount of, you know, well, we had a song way back when called Organized Confusion, which was on our first EP. So there's that element still runs through it. You know, there's a level of professionalism, but there's also a level of, well, what the fuck? Let's see what happens now, you know?
Yeah, man. Is it still the same guys, the original members who started out the band in the mid-70s?
Well, there's three of us. There's myself, Pete on guitar, and his brother, Kid, on drums. So we've been, you know, the backbone, the mainstays, and the constants in the band since day one.
Did you all grow up together? Were you all from Ipswich?
No, Pete and Kid, well, they kind of moved around. Their dad was in the military. So Kid was actually born in Cyprus. They lived in Berlin for a while when they were teenagers. But they eventually found their way to around Ipswich, where there's RAF bases. And so that's where Geordie, their dad, who was erstwhile manager of the band too, he was stationed there. And so they moved there in like the mid-70s, and, you know, we met some 76, 77. We didn't know each other as kids, but, you know, we weren't quite old men when we met. So.
Yeah, you found each other, I think, the right time. And like, Ipswich for me is one of the very few places in the UK I've never spent any time. So I don't know what it's like now, but what was it like growing up there in the early to mid 70s as you're discovering art, cinema, music, and kind of creative expression? Was it a place that was vibrant with that kind of stuff, or was it void of that kind of stuff? And if so, where were you getting a lot of your initial sources of, you know, inspiration and ignition to start doing music yourself?
I'm not a musician. I don't play anything. So I'm not necessarily, I wasn't like playing on my own or learning guitar or anything like that. I just never had that talent. So I never had any idea or aspiration to be in a band. And I didn't really know anybody that was, you know, in bands or that way inclined, like in the neighborhood. I mean, I just grew up on in council estate on the east of Ipswich. Yeah, pretty much a cultural desert, really. And there wasn't much that I was aware of going on until we started, getting into music at school. And I went through all kinds of phases. And initially I was, I guess glam rock was the first thing that really connected with me. Slade and Sweet, T-Rex, Bowie, Roxy Music, all of those classics.
The best, yeah, man. Right. I still think that stuff sounds fresh and exciting, and, you know, kind of like 50s rock and roll, but through the filter of futuristic space. That was kind of the vibe, wasn't it?
Yeah, I just watched that great documentary on Suzy Quatro called Suzy Q. That's
really
good, archive of that time too. So I don't know. I can't remember much going on other than what was on the telly, really. You know, Top of the Pops.
I was going to say Top of the Pops, right? That was where it was beaming all into the lounges from at that time.
Yeah. And then Old Grey Whistle Test, but a lot of that stuff was a bit too sort of avant-garde or sophisticated for me at the time, and I just didn't really connect to that. I went through a phase where I kind of like rock because that's what my friends were into, Black Sabbath and Wishbone Ash and Deep Purple and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Grew my hair out and wore a RAF trench coat and some desert boots, I think. But was never quite sure about it. So, this is all right, but it's not really what I'm looking for. And from there, I transitioned into kind of soul and funk.
Right.
But I can see an evolution. I went into soul and funk, and that kind of led me into the later period of Bowie, like Thin White Duke and Roxy Music. I started getting like Cockney Rebel, Bebop Deluxe.
Yeah.
Those kind of cool bands that wore suits and stuff like that, and started to pay a bit more attention to fashion and we were kind of soul boys at the time, I think, when we were listening to that kind of music. And we were listening to a lot of funk, like James Brown, Ohio Players, Cameo, and that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And we wore mohair jumpers that my mum knitted for me and my mates. And some punky shoes. And we would go down to Colchester because there wasn't really much happening in Ipswich. We would go down to Colchester on Sundays. And I think the club was called The Embassy. And we would go there mostly for the dance music. But there's suddenly we start to see like a shift in some of the people that were there. They were dressing and kind of dancing and looking different. And they were obviously a little bit closer to London than us. And so, you know, they were being influenced by perhaps listening to punk before we were even aware of it, or at least I was anyway. And so that became intriguing to me. I was as much interested in the fashion as I was the music. I was attracted to what they were wearing and how they were acting, but I didn't know what kind of music they were listening to. But there was something fascinating about it to me. And I think that those guys that we used to see at Colchester, and again, there's a small group of them. And I believe at the time they were in a band called The Lepers.
Great name.
Actually, The Addicts and The Lepers played a few shows, but although we were punks and we were kind of united, there was still like this geographical rivalry between Ipswich and Colchester or Ipswich and Norwich. So we attempted to play a couple of shows with those guys, but it just ended up in a mass brawl as far as I recall. But funnily enough, the Lepers, went off into like a new romantic phase and became Modern English.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that one song. What's the one song by them would be the big hit? I only know that one.
Yes, I'll Melt With You, which
yes,
is constantly on the radio over here.
Yeah, it was in one of those kind of 80s teen movies. I think it was in the film Valley Girl.
Right, yeah.
I
think they just played some shows over here, actually, because some retro festival or something like that. So they're still around.
I saw that with Devo and Blondie and Morrissey and all of those bands. Yeah. That looked like the dream 80s bill. So, I mean, this all sounds like a quintessential 70s British upbringing. And as far as like the Clockwork Orange stuff, was the book or the film the first thing that impacted you? Because I think for me, it was actually the book first. I ended up doing a dissertation at university on the book, on Ken Kesey's Cuckoo's Nest and Clockwork Orange, and how the two were these sort of quintessential 60s. Countercultural statements, but from different cultural standpoints on the times. And I was always fascinated by the fact that with the film, they left the final chapter of the book out, because the film sort of ends with Alex being cured, so he's able to do evil deeds again. And then the film ends on that note. But the book has an extra chapter where he goes back into that life. But what's happened is he's grown up and he's fallen out of love. And he sees one of his old droogs in like a coffee house with a partner. And he's all kind of loved up and mature. And that's when Alex goes, ah, that's the life I now want. And so he comes to that conclusion and decision to be good, quote unquote, of his own terms.
Comes to the conclusion or is forced to that conclusion?
Well, he's forced in the chapters that precede that by the mind control techniques. But what happens at the end is he chooses himself that he just no longer wants to live that life because he sees there's another path for him. And that was kind of the moral standpoint of the novel, was like, as it says in the film as well, it's better to be evil by choice than to be forced to be good, which is obviously a huge philosophical question that everybody will have different ideas on. But yeah, so for you as a young kid, punk's happening. That's inspiring you. Where does the kind of Clockwork Orange droog imagery come at you from?
I don't remember being very familiar with that. Around when the film was released, I never saw the movie in the cinema. And I believe I read the book, which I still have an early copy of it here with the glossary in the back.
The Nadsat terminology, yeah.
Right. So I believe I read the book before I'd even seen the film, and I think I saw the film on VHS bootleg for the first time. And I don't remember ever seeing it in the UK in the cinema.
He removed it, didn't he? Kubrick himself.
Yeah, he withdrew it from distribution. I can't remember the rationale for that. I think it was something to do with the violence it was generating, perhaps, or there might have been some other reason. I think
there was like copycat crimes taking place, and he was like, okay, well, if my film's being blamed, I'll just remove that from the equation by taking the film out of distribution. So like, when you're dressing up in those costumes and beginning to play for the first time, are you getting negative press as a band? Like, oh my god, they're copycatting this outrageous film. Like, what was the reaction to you guys donning those costumes early on?
Well, we didn't start with that look. We plagiarized that along the way. I mean, we started in Wikipedia might not say 1975, but that's complete bullshit. So
I was thinking that super early on, especially coming from Ipswich, like you're somehow ahead of the London punk scene.
I was still at school then, and I had no idea that I was about to descend. I mean, you know. So no, that's not. So
what would it have been, more like 79 or something?
No, 77, we met and we played a couple of shows under the name Pinz, P-I-N-Z. And we played in a scout hut in Oldborough, which is a sleepy seaside town in Suffolk. And then we played at the youth club that we often played at later and always rehearsed at for many years in Ipswich. So we did a couple of shows as Pinz, and then it was March 78 is when we did the first show as the Addicts. And I have the corroborating evidence for that because I kept a scrapbook at the time.
Amazing.
So, which I still have here. And the first page of my scrapbook is in the Punk World Museum now, with a Polaroid photograph that was taken in Oldborough Scout Hut, November 77, and the actual T-shirt that I was wearing at the time, which I had got some paint from my dad's shed, green paint and some red and splattered stuff on it, cut some holes in it, a white cap sleeve T-shirt it was. And I wrote in green paint the lyrics to the Clash's City of the Dead. And what we wear is dangerous gear, gets you picked on anywhere, and all that. So that's in the museum as well. So that's Now that's our beginning. So we were just snotty punk kids. So 78, 79, and we didn't adopt that Clockwork Orange look until I think late 1980 or 1981, because that's when the first album came out, Songs of Praise. And you know, the thought process behind that was, it just looked cool, I think. It's like, wouldn't it be cool if we dressed like that? And because it was, you know, this was, you're getting close to the second wave of punk when it's all leathers and spikes,
GBH and all that stuff, yeah.
A more hardcore street punk look. And, you know, it was an alternative to the alternative look, you know. We weren't looking, and as a matter of fact, not sounding like all those bands, which were great in their own, you know, style, but, you know, we always wanted to sound and look a little different. And I don't recall it ever being any kind of great deep intellectual kind of epiphany or anything like that. Well, and analyzing what Clockwork Orange meant and what it would mean if we dressed like this and made this statement. It's just like, fuck, that's cool. Let's just do that. You know?
How did the punks themselves react to you guys? As you're saying, it's getting a bit tougher, a bit right. Street, and you're sharing bills with, I imagine, you know, like biker gangs, skinheads, all these kind of like, yeah, you know, tough characters. So how were the crowds and indeed some of the other bands themselves reacting to this theatrical outfit of, you know, flamboyant kind of zany right. out there, and you're, you know, daring to have fun? What was the take from within the scene towards you guys?
Well, mixed, because again, at the same time, we, you know, I think maybe a little bit before the whole band started, that look, I had started wearing the makeup as well. And, you know, being more flamboyant in my dress and in my persona and all that kind of stuff, you know, really kind of growing into that monkey. Well, I don't want to say character, but side of me, you know?
Persona.
Yeah. So there was a lot of backlash from certain bands that kind of really like to get themselves in Sounds or Enemy or Melody Maker, and it was good press. You know, it's good for the magazines to have a little, you know, fight between a couple of bands, you know, it's a little juicy, some gossip and all that. So there were a few bands like Special Duties, another Colchester band. They would like to give us shit. There was a band from fucking Northampton or somewhere. I think they were the Destructors. You know, they would like to make T-shirts, the Addicts of Shit, stuff like that. And yeah, because we're not punk, you know, and all that crap. And then I think we had some run-ins with Discharge and Conflict and those guys. I remember seeing sprayed on a wall while we, you know, you do the same circuit and play all these shitholes. And I think we got to some place the night after one of those bands had played, and it was like, oh, the Addicts of Puss sprayed on the wall or something like that, you know. we took lightheartedly, but you know, we were also quite capable of taking care of ourselves, and we wouldn't shirk at you know, a confrontation or two if someone was besmirching our name.
Gotta defend your honor, right?
and then part of that classic working class upbringing was that we were football hooligans as well. You know, I was an Ipswich supporter, and Pete and Kid are still Sunderland supporters. So maybe a slightly tougher upbringing up there down in Ipswich. But you know, so we come from that, you know, football hooligan kind of back, beer drinking, beer swilling, you know, hooligan rock kind of background as well. So yeah, we were capable of looking after ourselves in that respect. So yeah, there was a few bands that kind of made us targets.
What about on the flip side, what bands at that point, you know, were really into what you guys were doing and, you know, backed you up and talked nicely about you in the press and, you know, would kind of be in your corner and shouting about the Addicts in positive, complimentary ways.
I think that's, again, that's probably more, you know, positive support than the naysayers. And we got a lot of support from the press, from like Gary Busher and Carol Clark, and Melody Maker, and stuff like that. They were very supportive of us. We had lots of features. Again, because we were different, I think, and that's what was attractive to them. We had a sense of humor. We didn't take ourselves too seriously. So we were a good interview.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah,
and a good photo shoot as well.
Yeah, and yeah, of course there were dozens and dozens of points of Guinness involved back then. But so I always got sloppy and messy and fun.
Were the shows very much fueled by liquids and powders back in those days?
Not so much powders. We were just drinkers mostly. We never got deep into drugs. We were never, you know, we had tested everything, tried everything, but we did have a modicum of professionalism that we tried not to be too pissed. It didn't always happen. And if we were going to do some kind of drug, we would like to make sure we were doing the same drug. You know,
well, that's when it goes wrong, isn't it? Is when everybody's on different stuff.
That was a rule.
The rule of democracy. We all must share the same intoxicants. So at what point do you make the trip over the pond and begin playing in the States? Because I know, you know, a lot of UK bands didn't get over there for quite some time. I just saw actually the other day, Tim Smith is going over to the States with the adverts, or a version of the adverts, for the first time ever this year, which seems insane to me.
He was just here. I didn't get to see him. He played a couple of shows in LA. But yeah, that's amazing. 1983 was the first time we came out.
Right, wow.
Not that long into a career, really, you know. Consider we'd started playing in scout huts and youth clubs, you mm-hmm. know, within, you know, 4 or 5 years, we're, you know, flying out to California and getting picked up by a limo, and then playing to 5,000 people.
Wow. And at that point over there, it's kind of the beginning of the whole, I guess, Black Flag, Circle Jerks, X, Germs, that kind of era, a bit more hard or hardcore. Who were the American bands that you would play with when you started coming over initially, and how did the American crowds take to you guys? Did they kind of love you from the outset because of the theatricality? And because they're always, I think, a bit more receptive to that kind of stuff over there, aren't they? And especially British bands that have an already established, in their eyes, legitimacy when it comes to genres like punk, like, you know, bands like The Damned and stuff. When they're going over there originally, the Americans are like, oh my god, you know, these UK legends coming over. Did you have that kind of a response from the outset?
Yeah, we did. We were kind of, you know, welcomed with open arms by the promoters. And the guys that brought us out initially were Golden Voice, when they were just kind of just growing as punk rock promoters.
Yeah.
But now Coachella, of course. But yeah, it was remarkable for us to come from playing those, you know, relatively small shows. I mean, we didn't play in London until, I believe, 1980 or something like that. You know, we played again, pubs, a pub called the Breakknob, I think, was our first gig in London. Then we started playing some shows at the Marquee, often with Chelsea. But then we came over here, and because the bills were big, they were probably like 10 opening bands, Jodie Foster's Army, and lots of local bands like that.
Also a great band name.
They're the first ones that spring to mind, but there were many, many others. But we also came with, the first time we came, 1983, we came with Peter and the Test Tube Babies.
Right.
For both of us, it was our first trip over here and our first experience. So, you know, that was a lot of fun, just being on the road with those guys. And when I say on the road, I think we probably did 6 shows or something like that. It was only the West Coast.
Still a lot of road over there, though.
Well, yeah.
What about the Dickies? I would imagine, I'm not sure at what point you met those guys or if you're friends or whatever now, but I kind of, you know, link you two in my mind as cut from similar cloths. Do you share an affinity or a kinship or a connection or friendship with those guys? And have you shared many bills together over the years?
Yes. And yes to all of that. My two favorite American bands, probably the only two that I were really familiar with back in 1977 or 78 were the Ramones and the Dickies, because the Dickies had, you know, Banana Splits and were on Top of the Pops. Subsequently we were over here and moved over here. I've been here 30 years now. And so we played lots of shows with the Dickies, and I can call Stan and Leonard my friends now, which, you know, is remarkable that, you know, I had those posters on the wall. The same with the Damned and the Vibrators and all those kind of, you know, people that influenced me and entertained me. You are very fortunate to get to meet, and, you know, you can pick up the phone and call some of those guys now. You know, it's beautiful, really. So the Dickies, similar in style and attitude. Leonard and I are both really just prop comics fronting punk bands, you know.
Prop comedians, but so good at it, so good at it. I'll be seeing Stan in a few weeks on the Flogging Molly cruise. He's on there every year with Punk Rock Karaoke. So, I've been doing that cruise for 3 years, and I keep saying to Darren, the drummer, 1 year I'll get up and sing with you guys. This might be the year I finally do it.
I usually do New Rose, so you can take that one if you want.
Nice. Yeah. Classic, yeah. The first punk single, yeah.
Yeah.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So, what made you want to move and stay in the States? Was it love? Was it a lady? Was it the weather?
I remember thinking that the first time we came here, okay, this is all right. I could, you know, settle down here for sure in 1983. You know, we were drinking cheap champagne and lolling around the pool and stuff like that. And so, a lot of fun. A few years later, I met Lisa, who ended up being my wife. So I moved out here in 93, got married. So I've been here since then. And that was the motivation was love, not music.
Well, it's a very powerful driving force in many things.
Yeah, but so... Pete, the guitarist, has been here as long as I have, if not a little longer too, and, you know, for the same reason. So that kind of it's a bit of a paradigm shift that we ended up kind of being a California band because of that, you know.
Yeah, I guess that's part of the reason why you're so embraced and adored over there still. At what point do you kind of take a break that becomes the extended break? Was that around that time?
We've had a few breaks over the years. So, I came here in 93. We did one horrible tour in early 94. And, you know, bands go through, you know, highs and lows. And this was a bit of a low, maybe for punk in general and for the band. It was like there wasn't much interest. So we did this massive 6-week tour of the US. We came back, you know, broken, disillusioned, and kind of just went our separate ways for a while after that.
That seems crazy to me, because like at that exact moment is when the entire record industry is turning its eyes on punk for the first time, probably since 77, 78, and right. Catching in with Green Day, Rancid, NOFX, Offspring, all of those bands. But was it right. Just the case that like anything pre-grunge was of no interest to them?
I think, it just wasn't of any interest to the people that were coming to the shitholes that we were playing throughout the Midwest and the South and where else. But I don't really know exactly why, but it was just kind of a slow time for us. So we came back off that and we just kind of drifted. I ended up moving to San Francisco, lived out there for 3 years. I think Kid went and moved to the north of England and bred dogs, lived on the moors or somewhere. And
I was going to ask, I hope it's not too much of a personal question, but like when you are a touring, working, full-time band and then you do take a break from that, how do you exist as a human? Like, do you still create and write music? Do you just do it for other people, or do you find other sources of income, or have you got a bit of royalties to live off for a bit? It must be quite a hard shift to make because you're so used to your income coming from, you know, records and touring and all of that stuff that then all of a sudden...
Well, income from touring. We don't really make any income from anything else. We've never had any great commercial success. We don't have a revenue flow. If we're not on the road, we don't make money. We've all had regular jobs all the time.
Right.
Apart from those 10 years I was on the dole in the early days, we've all worked and we've had to.
Right. You know, well, what could be more punk than that?
Right. And that's through necessity rather than choice, and we'll continue to do. We there's no addicts 401k or retirement fund or anything like that, you know. So and I console myself with the fact that the payoff is, well, we've had a brilliant time and we've made a lot of people very happy.
That you have and continue to. And do you do a lot outside of music in terms of your creativity? Because it seems like, you know, you say you're not a musician, but you definitely strike me as someone who's like an artist with a voice and you know, likes to express themselves. Does that take on other forms aside from singing and performing live with your bands?
Yeah, I have developed as an artist, I think. I've always been a lyricist. And kind of a dabbler as a writer. I wrote some screenplays a few years ago that really didn't really go anywhere, but I enjoyed the process. And then really COVID kind of drove me into being more like a visual artist, a painter, a sculptor, a weirdo, an eccentric, because that, you know, all of my creative flow would come through the shows, the clothes that I would make or customize myself.
Have you always done all your own makeup and props and clothing, all of that? Yeah.
Yeah, always done that. Even from the early days, when I would sit at home getting my mum's the old mail order catalogs, your mum used to get those big fat ones that were sort of glossy, so I would just sit there cutting those up to make confetti, and just make bags to take to the shows. I would save the women's underwear section. I wouldn't.
Of course, I was going to say that was like pornography for us back in the day, wasn't it? A brassiere here or there.
Maybe a nipple. Is that a nipple one? I think so. So yeah, it's always been the DIY in that sense, with, you know, clothes and props and all that kind of stuff. And as we got a little more, you know, cash flow, then we always invested more money into that. You know, yeah, the current day, you know, we have balls bouncing around and we have confetti flying through the air, and that's money that's, you know, being thrown at the audience there too. You know, so but we're aware of the impact of that, and if, you know, that has on a show, not on the audience. So what was the question again?
Art outside of singing, visual art.
I've been banging out a couple of things today. So,
well, here we go. Let's have a little exclusive look. Are you involved in the punk rock and the paintbrushes collective?
I've had a couple of things and some of their exhibitions, yeah. And then when I'm at the Punk Rock Museum, I kind of take stuff out there and try and flog it out of the back of my truck.
Amazing.
And I've done like pop-ups around LA, flea markets and that kind of stuff, and a few things in galleries and all that. But I was just like banging out a little Debbie Harry today.
There she is.
Stuff, and there's a Bowie. I like down and dirty quick art. I'm not a fine artist. I don't have the patience for it. But I just like it's a song or a performance. You want instant kind of results and gratification, I guess, in some way. So I kind of like the art to be like that.
Did you do the cover to your solo album?
That was I conceptually, yes, but I didn't do the art. That's art by Bad Otis Link.
Right, because it looks like a very similar vibe to what you've just shown me there.
Yeah, it is somewhat, but no, Otis is like a legendary LA artist. He, again, going back to Golden Voice in those early punk days, he did all of their posters and flyers and stuff like that.
Right on.
He's he lives out like in Joshua Tree in the desert now, in the temple, but yeah, amazing guy and amazing art. So he's a friend, so he did that for me. But all this, the painting and the whatever the fuck you want to call it, really came through COVID, when that creativity that usually would go into the shows had nowhere to go. And I just started messing around about here. I just have an apartment. I have a little balcony out there. It's covered in paint and stuff like that. So
that doubles up as the studio.
I don't think I'm ever going to get my security deposit back if the landlord sees it.
It's funny for me. COVID was, I think, a test in some ways of true creatives, because I think true creatives always find a way to create, and whatever hurdles are presented in front of them, the ones who really love expressing themselves will always find a way. I think it's the fair weather kind of, you know, business-minded creatives that if there's a blockade in the way, they'll give up and, you know, maybe turn their hand to something else. But if you have stuff inside you that you need to get out, and one form is taken away, you're just going to adapt and find another, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. That's what happened to me. I mean, I was itching for some kind of outlet, and, you know, and the stuff I did at the beginning was horrible. But again, that's process, because you do it as a songwriter, as an artist, as a writer, whatever it is you do, you kind of know sometimes that this is not real good, but if I don't get through this, I won't get to the good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to earn the release of your greatness, haven't you? Right. Put in that 1,000 hours. Hey, have you ever opened up for Alice Cooper?
No, I don't even think I've even seen Alice Cooper.
Wow. Okay. So whoever your agent or who's in charge of your live stuff is, that's the move. Because, I mean, it's exactly the same thing to me. It's the theater. It's, you know, it's entertainment. It's cartoony. It's shocking. It's funny. And he was just over in the UK, and they had the Tubes opening up. And it worked really well. You know, I think a lot of the audience were just like, what the fuck? Because a lot of Alice Cooper fans are obviously just kind of like hard rock guys and don't quite understand the full kind of like avant-garde roots of that band. But I think Addicts Alice Cooper would be the perfect night out. Halloween tour. There it is.
All right. That's...
just pitching you.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going out to the desert next week to go to the punk rock museum and go to a wedding out there. So Alice Cooper's often playing golf out there. So maybe I'll run into him on the golf course. Not that I play golf, but I can go look for him.
Go start. They do say that's where a lot of business deals get done out in LA and that side of the world, isn't it? Is on the golf course over 18 holes. So have you done a tour yet, or will these upcoming ones be your first of the museum?
Oh, this will be my third run at it. I was out there in April and June, and now I've got three more dates in November. I'm also doing a DJ slot on Sunday night.
That's what I do. That's my other gig aside from this. That's my full-time sort of earner, really. I love it. Have you done many of them?
No.
It's easy. It's all about the choice of tunes, you know, and then you just hit play. It's fine.
There won't be any actual discs involved, and I don't know how much jockeying I'll be doing, but I do have a playlist, so I think that's...
You're 90% of the way there, Monkey. You're 90%
of the way there. I need a microphone, and that was, you know...
I do a bit of that. I'm partial to a bit of that. My background's in radio, so I can't help myself, no matter how big or small the room. Yeah. You know, I like to give a bit of context and, you know, anecdotal sprinklings around.
It's a bit of a frustrating project, but I've been talking to a radio station about having a show for quite some time now. And so I did put playlists together and I did put liners together and kind of, you know, develop some shows. And I kind of really, I like that. I like the searching for the songs and then the search for, you know, the corroborating material to go with the songs, not just like the stats or this came out then and this on
the threads that tie it all together, right?
And because, and so it connects like my day job, like with the museum and maybe be putting these radio shows together, is that my day job is archaeologist and historical researcher.
Wow. And
so it's a nice connection that I could do research on punk rock and find stories and connections between bands and, you know, like how, you know, Glasgow's first punk band, Johnny and the Self Abusers, ended up being Simple Minds and, you know,
love stuff that.
Like who was the other one I liked? Someone's going to get their head kicked in tonight. You know that song?
The Rizzillos.
Well, a bunch of other people covered it. Dropkick Murphys, I think, have done it. And all kinds of bands have done it. That was fucking written by Fleetwood Mac.
I never knew that. Which particular members of Fleetwood Mac, do you know?
Pre
Stevie and...
69 or something like that. Something like that. But it's their version's up on YouTube or somewhere like that. But yeah, it was a B-side that they used like a fake band name for it, I think, which escapes me right now. Wow. But anyway, finding little nuggets like that that connect songs, you know.
Well, it already sounds like you put more work and effort into it than Steve Jones has ever done for his radio shows.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that I do.
No. Steve Jones, as much as I adore listening to his radio shows, he just kind of puts up the mic and wings it, doesn't he? That's half the charm.
Yeah. Well, obviously he's in LA, so I've listened to it in the past. I don't listen to it very often.
I don't even think he's doing it still. I think he stopped it a couple of years back, but yeah. So he is obviously someone who's been there a while as well. Billy Duffy from The Cult. There seems to be a few Brits who've kind of like landed there and stayed there. And it seems to be that you get treated pretty good. Has that been your experience as well? They love the Brits.
Well, yeah, they love the Brits, but I also love the, the guys in the Brit bands. I mean, you mentioned Billy Duffy, so I don't know Billy Duffy, but I'm good friends with Phil Rowland, who's good friends with Billy Duffy. And Phil lives out here too. He just lives in Reseda. And so he played drums on my solo thing. And nice. Phil was Aaron Slaughter and the Dogs and the Nips and bands I hear, like London Cowboys. An amazing drummer and done lots of cool stuff. So, yeah, he's just down the road, and we might do some stuff together again at some point soon. Lost my train of thought again.
Mm-hmm. It's all good, man. It's all good. Well, we're nearly at the hour, so we can wrap in a little while. But yeah, it's been really lovely talking to you, man. And the Addicts for me were one of the very first. So I'm 37. So my generation was very much the aforementioned American bands that I referred to earlier, Offspring, Rancid, etc. And then through discovering them as a kind of teenager, I then went back and traced the fruit all the way to the root and, found the Clash and Pistols and bands like that. But the Addicts were always a band that I loved early on because of the whole visual presentation of the thing, being as obsessed with Clockwork Orange and dystopian literature as I was. So, yeah, always been a big fan of the bands. Still never seen you, though, which still breaks my heart. In terms of the kind of touring schedule for the Addicts, what's on the docket at the moment? And is there anything kind of down the line for either UK or US listeners?
We played three shows in July here in Southern California, and they were our first shows in over 3 years.
How were they?
It was great. I mean, obviously there was the demand because we haven't been around much lately. So, we played headline two shows ourselves that, sold out the first day or two, thousand capacity kind of rooms. And then we played a festival down in Santa Ana, which is like south of LA. And we were like special guests to a band called The Garden, who have this kind of clown image too. So their audience is much larger. But anyway, but there were 9,000 people at this festival, and, it was real good for us. And there were like lots of white faces in the crowd, some for us and some for them. So that was a good experience. So we came out of that buoyed by that experience. But we're a little older than we used to be. And so
you spread out a bit, right?
And so me and Peter here, kids in England, and the other two guys that are in the band are German, and they live in Berlin. So, we have always had some logistical issues with scheduling and stuff like that. So we have to take our time these days as to when we can plan anything like that. So at the moment, we're talking about perhaps something in spring. And that's, about as far on as we are with that at the moment.
For bands like yourselves, the big ones at the moment is kind of punk rock, Bowling, and then Rebellion. And I guess they seem to be the kind of...
That's right. And then there's also Punk in the Park, which is out here in this week, actually. I think Punk in the Park is the biggest punk festival in the US.
Wow, is it?
Yeah.
Pennywise are doing it, aren't they, this year, so? They'll also be on the boat in a couple of weeks, as will Broilers, a German punk band. I imagine you probably toured a lot with Die Totenhausen. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Die Totenhausen, the Dead Trousers.
Great band, they are.
Oh, yeah, they're amazing. And we've been friends with them since the 80s when they were just up and coming. And, I think they might have opened for us at a couple of shows. But that's quickly switched. And so we've played some of their, we've been guests on some of their smaller tours where they only play to 20,000 people. We don't play the big ones when it's, 100,000 a night.
Yeah, they're like a stadium band, aren't they? They're like Bon Jovi big over there.
Yeah, incredibly popular in Germany and rest of Europe. But England, I think they just played Rebellion this year.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Finding anything like that. And I don't know that they've ever played in the US. They're popular in Argentina, like many other Germans, perhaps. And then, but they've always been good to us, friends, and yeah, the drummer is English form. He was in Doctor in the Medics back in the day.
No way.
Yeah, he's played in a bunch of other bands, yeah. So,
before I let you go, what did you think of the Joker film? Did you enjoy it?
I hadn't seen it, so I can't tell you.
Oh, mate, you got to check it out. I mean, so is clowning something of interest to you? Or are you not really someone who's sort of, you know, invested in a student of that particular art form? It just happens to be that you, you know, don similar attire and paint and stuff. Because I'm fascinated by the whole history and artistry of that particular medium of performance. I think it's just so interesting and magical and dark and funny and brilliant.
Yeah, I'm interested to it, like I said, but I'm not really a student, not studied the art. But the look, or my look, obviously has some influence from, you know, the Joker, Batman. But the Joker when I was growing up was the Cesar Romero.
Of course.
But that look also, you know, has its influences from the Man Who Laughed. Have you ever seen that movie?
I haven't, but it's like an old black and white silent film,
right? No, he gets stuck like that. He just can't stop smiling.
There's the money shot right there.
There's that panic grin on the whole time. You know, it came from there, and there's other, you know, other white faces, like, you remember, like, the Alex Harvey band?
Of course. The sensational Alex Harvey band. What age did you realize that was a trait that you had that you could, you know, accentuate and manipulate and cash in on? Was there a moment of realization where you're like, oh, this is a thing that I can dial up?
My recollection of that is that, when we were doing shows and people would take photographs, and, you know, a week later you go to Boots and get your prints. And I would always mug at the camera. Well, if I saw a camera, I was always doing that before I had the makeup. And I started seeing this grin, and I thought, well, that's, maybe there's something there. And I think from that, Pete designed that first logo that we had. And I think he just, you know, incorporated that based on, you know, what I was doing and what we were seeing in the photographs. And then, you know, the development of that was, oh, there's a logo, and then why don't I make myself more like the logo, more like a caricature? And that's kind of when the, you know, the evolution of the makeup started.
It's genius, really. Someone once said to me that, like, the best thing you can do as any sort of performer, or indeed public figure in the entertainment sector, is be recognizable by silhouette. And that's when you know, like, you've really, you know, if you see, like, the outline of a Marilyn Monroe or an Elvis or a Michael Jackson or someone like that, right, you're like, that's true icon status. And well, addicts have that.
You've got for these ears then.
Addicts have it, man. It's your trait, it's your calling card, and long may it remain. I would recommend the Joker film. I think you'd really enjoy it. It's very inspired by King of Comedy, the Scorsese film. It's a massive kind of nod to that. And it's brilliant.
Second one's about to come out, isn't it?
It is. So you can do the first and then jump straight into the second. Well, dude, listen, I'm going to let you go. Thank you for working with me on rearranging the time as well. And it's good that we did, because I literally, the second we started this, you know, conversation, I just sat down and come through the door. So thank you for being flexible. Thank you for being generous with your time. And thank you for the music and all the years of entertainment, mate.
Oh, thank you for the support. And if you need anything else, any more info or anything like that, you know where to find me.
Thank you. And yeah, if I'm ever that side, which I will be, would love to meet up and go for a bite to eat, or a, you know, a beer or a soda water, whatever your drink of choice is. And and hope you come see a show.
I haven't drunk any of that Guinness for 10 years now. So
Good on you. Well, we'll have a Guinness Zero. That's good stuff, that is.
You know what? I was talking to my mate in England the other day because he said he drinks it. And I saw a commercial on a telly for it as well. Since I quit drinking, which is 10 years ago, I never had any inclination for like non-alcoholic beer or wine. Or I never even tasted a non-alcoholic beer. Just don't have the need. But I always thought, if I ever did start drinking again, the first thing I would drink would be a pint of Guinness. And I thought, well, maybe I could just try the zero alcohol then, because it seems like it gets good reviews, right?
For me, Guinness is my favorite drink in the world. I think it is the best drink in the world. And the Guinness Zero is identical in every way, apart from the texture and the kind of thickness of it. It tastes the same. It's just slightly more watered down. Something in the brewing process minus the alcohol makes it a little bit more, you know, thin. But other than that, it's pretty much like the real thing. And it's the best of the 0%, you know, replica.
The real thing in some shitty pub in the 70s then.
That's it. That's exactly it. Yeah. You're like, oh, there's something wrong with the lines. No, no, it's just zero. Well, listen, dude, good luck with the tours. See you down the road. And thanks again for coming on the show and hanging out and telling some stories. Really enjoyed it.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.